Good evening. Thank you for putting the ox herding on the website. That's very helpful.
I printed out, I just for fun, I took the ones from GT Suzuki,
mm-hmm.
and reformatted them. So I have like five copies here. It's identical content. It's just laid out a little bit cleaner.
Oh, that's neat.
So if anybody wants a copy, I don't know what you're handing out, but I've got a...
And Donna Lynn's got a bunch, too, so... Yes, I don't think we're going to talk about them tonight, or at least we don't need to. I thought we could finish up the Heart Sutra tonight a little bit, or whatever else you all are interested in talking about.
So the first one that Dan is passing out is the...
Do you already got the copy?
Yes.
Drawings.
The first one is the book that Angie has right there, mm-hmm. Riding the Ox Home by drawn Dale Laurie, and it has some modern paintings or monographs or prints, and the book itself has commentary. And the second one, is Paul Rebs, which is, he did a lot of the original translations. This is from Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. It's also a contemporary woodblock print on it. And this last one. Oh.
Good save.
How did
the water not go out?
It's the first time I take the water out of it.
Good thinking, Sonia.
Would anyone like a copy of the GT Suzuki one?
Yes.
And the third handout is something I came across in, I believe it's a
thank
German
you.
Or Danish study on probably somebody's thesis on Zen Masters and Meditation, Images and Writing. And it has on the back what they think is very old. Yeah. 1400s. So it is not 200s. Not only
'Cause. So the nicest part about this is that it's all illustrated. You don't get much illustration in Zen, but this way it invites illustration. So you all are all invited to illustrate the ox herding pictures as we go along. The reason I'm focusing on this book is because Dido Laurie takes a Zen, a kind of contemporary Zen and deeper approach to it than just the straight kind of ambitious, goal-oriented take on this metaphor. In his view, you can enter this at any point, and that there are many different that all the many different aspects keep coming up in our life, so that we're not going somewhere. We're just in various states of being, and sometimes we're searching for the ox, and sometimes we've actually are riding on something, or have disappeared into the thin air. But there's no fixed state, and no state to aim for. So this is sometimes taken as a kind of guide to enlightenment, but it can be very frustrating and actually limiting if we take it that way. And we get ambitious, and then as we sit, we try to get some kind of feeling or some kind of state. But any feeling or state that we get and try to hold on to isn't it. So it's a little bit tricky, but yes.
I don't know. I've never actually thought about it this way before. I don't want to get into a definition of what's a koan, but are these in essence koans?
I think so. I think so. I think they're used that way. I don't know how much it's used, actually. Nobody I know who's teaching uses these.
As koans.
As koans. But it certainly sounds like a koan.
Well, the reason I ask is the way you explained it, that it's not a, you know, you go through stages 1, 2, 3, up to 10.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more like, oh, here's the description of where I am.
Yes.
It's kind of like the reverse. It's a descriptor rather than a... And in that mm-hmm. sense, you know, I think true penetration of koans is not penetrating, but letting them penetrate you.
So yeah.
In that sense, they are, but they're not, you don't, much with koans, you don't necessarily attack them one by one, and there's no, Mumon said that he listed his koans, the 48 koans, in a random order.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't by level or by sequence or by depth.
But some teachers do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it really, there isn't any golden rule about it at all. So we'll talk more about it next week when you have a chance to read all of this material. It's nice that we have it. There's so much available. And thank you both for making that available. Yes. More confusion.
I did notice in one of the other references, the one in A Flower Does Not Fall, the one he uses is not 10. It's another version which has only 6, I think.
Hmm.
And then I think in the preamble to that, he gives a history of the multiple versions of it.
Oh, I'll have to look at that again.
Yeah, I thought that was... Yeah,
oh, that's fun. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm assuming that, you know, the one, these things are all 10.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, and this article has some history.
That's great, great.
So yeah. It's interesting.
Very, very.
So in the meantime, I didn't know whether you all wanted to talk a little bit more about the Heart Sutra or whether you've done with it. You're smiling.
I never
you can never be done, Wendy. It's true. Ever, ever.
Reading a, it's called The Essence of the Heart Sutra by the Dalai Lama. And, it's a couple of years old. And the first, it's like halfway in the book before he even really talks about the content of the Heart Sutra. And the first part of it is that he talks about how the Heart Sutra, I think we were talking about how the Heart Sutra is used in other traditions. So he talks a bit about what Buddhism is and how it relates to other world religions, and then he talks about how the Heart Sutra then relates within the other Buddhist traditions. So it's the book's worth just the first couple chapters in that. So.
Mm.
So what is the title of the book? It's The Essence of the Heart Sutra.
Yes.
Well, there was one thing that I wanted to point out about it. I didn't know whether that came up last time you all talked about it, and that is the three sections of the sutra and how they express. The first section, which is, you know, form doesn't differ from emptiness. Form and emptiness make one whole, which is really describing our dichotomous mind, that we're always seeing one side and then the other side. And this sutra is saying, but that both sides belong together. They're inextricably one with each other. But still, they're two sides. Form and emptiness. And then it goes on to talk about the bodhisattva. So practicing, we begin by a sense of separation. But as we practice, bodhisattva practice leads us to realize that there's nothing to hold on to, that there's no real ground under our feet. And there is nothing to depend on except wisdom itself. As it carries us, and as we live and express as it, you could say. And so in the second part of it, the bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita, and mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. So from this dichotomous mind, it goes way out there. But that isn't enough. Way out there is just another state, you could say. If you get stuck there, it's just another stuck place. And that's why the mantra at the end, which is really the essence of the Whole Heart Sutra, the gate, gate, para gate, para sam gate, beyond, beyond. Going beyond all the ideas, even the most exalted ideas like nirvana, beyond form and emptiness, so that form is form and emptiness is emptiness. And the svaha, according to Kansa, means right now. So it's this sort of carrying on, going on, right now. So it's a full circle also, from Avalokiteshvara, practicing deeply. It goes all the way back to the practicing deeply again. So you're right, we can never get to the bottom of all of it, but it's part of our bones and blood now, because we've been chanting it every single night that we get together, and every single session it becomes an integral part of our life in a way. So that's what I thought to say about the Heart Sutra, but perhaps you have some questions. Jane?
You talk about Prajnaparamita, and I think I know the answer to this, but I still want to hear you say it, Angie. That there's prajna, and then there's compassion, and I think Avalokiteshvara, because she's the one.
Well, the paramitas are the perfections, the bodhisattva perfections. So prajna paramita is the sixth in the list. So prajna is wisdom. And so Avalokiteshvara is practicing meditation, which is the wisdom. There's mindfulness, and then there's meditation. And they're separate practices. So Avalokiteshvara is practicing deep meditation.
And that's how the two are together.
Fit, yes. It's very nice that it fits in such a nice and satisfying way. That it, because, as we always say, you can't have real wisdom without compassion, and vice versa. Somebody there? Well, Ruth, hello.
Can I come up here so I can listen to you?
Sure. How nice.
I'm going to warm up.
And we should have introductions. You should hear everybody's name. You won't remember, but...
No. I'm Dan.
Hi, Dan. Wendy.
Lauren.
Samia.
Rick.
Donald.
Jane.
Ruth usually sits on Wednesday night.
Right.
You said you might come.
Well, there's a teacher that comes to our place sometimes on Wednesday nights. And I really like her. I hope it's okay.
You're very welcome.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm still late. I didn't know I started at 6:30.
What time do you start?
It's okay.
7:30.
Ah,
perfect time.
Yeah, you're right on time.
Well,
Yes.
I don't know. Here's the engineer in me working again. Is there a sequential logic here? So the bodhisattva depends on prajna paramita, and then the mind's no hindrance. And then it's in the next sentence, says without any hindrance. So does that mean that if it's A and B, actually A leads to B and then B leads to C. So in this case, mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. So does that mean that the mind is the producer of the fears?
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, just by, although the English isn't quite clear, I don't think, but I think it's inferred that the perverted views are also products of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just let the mind be and rest on prajna, then the fears and the perverted views settle by themselves and we dwell in nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that logic?
Yes.
Too far off?
Yes, I think that's exactly what it's saying.
So what is it then, or does the sutra not say why we depend so much on our mind? I mean, here they're telling us don't depend on the mind, depend on the prajna. But we have a tendency to depend on the mind instead.
Yes.
And does the sutra explain why that dependence pre-exists, or is it just an assumption? Just a recognition that we all do it?
It's just a recognition.
Uh-huh.
It's how we operate. No, there's the mind of distinctions and intellect, and then there's the more deeply intuitive mind that can't be engineered, you could say. You can't force it to do what we're lived by that mind rather than the other way around.
So that raises a consequential question. That is that this prajna, Suzuki Roshi would call it the big mind, and the mind I was referring to a moment ago is the little mind.
Mm.
And your comment kind of raises a very interesting point that it's still mind. It's a bigger portion of what we normally think of as the mind. But it's still mind. It's still us. It's still in us.
Sure.
Okay. Sure.
Prajna is too big to even conceive. And small mind is a part of that. There's no way not to be a part of it in terms of big mind and small mind.
So again, when these priests I love the koan so much, when they say, you know, I'm so glad my teacher didn't give it to me on a silver platter, I went and got it.
Mm-hmm.
Or got it's the wrong word, but saw it, recognized it, was with it, that he, on all his walkings around on pilgrimage, he had it with him all the time.
Yeah. And nobody can tell anybody else. You have to find it in yourself. So and our tendency is to think it. So it's our deepening as our meditation deepens, we depend less and less on thinking. We begin to see through the thinking. The thinking just goes around in circles, chatters away. Even if there aren't any problems, it's still just chattering away. And you begin to see through it. It's not such a treasure as we might have thought, even. It's just a kind of little noisy fellow in there carrying on. But there's a whole lot more going on. And as they study the brain more and more, it gets to be very interesting because so many things are being discovered about how little effect the one that says I actually has on her or his life. not very much. It's quite mysterious. You know, your brain, they've measured that your brain already has decided to lift your arm before you lifted your arm. You lift your arm, I lift my arm, and I think, I lifted my arm. I did it. But a few seconds before I thought that, I'd already thought it somewhere else. It's weird. But if you think about it, you can see how it works in your life. If you take your own motivation out of it, you can feel how your life flows. And that actually a lot of it is looking at your life in retrospect. Even if it's a couple of seconds in retrospect, it's still retrospect. Oh, I put the bread in the toaster. Well, who put the bread in the toaster, I wonder? Because I didn't do that. It was put in, and then I saw that I'd put it in. Very mysterious. So Zen has been talking about that for hundreds of years. Zen asks, who is it that lifts your eyebrows and blinks your eyes?
So who burned the toast?
It's not my fault.
Burned a long time. Yeah.
Explaining to the fire department. Oh, with my prajna paramita.
That's what he said. Twice. Yesterday and today.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be trying to get that out.
Two times in a row. Oh, well.
Andy, I have a question about Gati Gati. Blanking out on her name. She said, gone, gone, gone. And you said, beyond, beyond. So to me, they're two different things. You said beyond, and Carolyn said gone.
I think the way it's usually, let's see, I've got a note here. Gati comes from a word that means to go or to understand, which is an interesting combination. And it means gone. So, and then para means beyond. So paragati is into the gone beyond. So it's gone into the gone beyond, and then parasamgati means into the gone completely beyond.
So what is gone?
All the teachings, the sutra, all our understandings, everything that we think and try to hold on to. So it's a way of just dropping off everything and being where you are. So that's the last thing right now. Bodhisvaha. Bodhi means enlightenment. So it's just bam, right now. So it's about how nothing stays. It's gone or going. And then it's going beyond, and you could say beyond understanding if you want to put the understanding in there. Way beyond anything that we can understand. And then parasamgati has gone completely beyond.
So that comes though after you've really done your work.
Yes.
So it's not like, so if I understand it correctly, is when it comes down to it, it's just none of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were to put it musically, so you're studying this piece of music, you have to really know the notes, this, know it really good, and at the end, really you have to put your own interpretation, or else it would be Bach and Beethoven. You'd be like a robot if you don't put your own self in it.
Yes.
But you can't just put yourself in it without really studying it. You can't just say, I'm going to wing it.
Yeah.
So you really have to do the homework. You can't just say, I'm just going to make up my own practice. I'm going to go, you know, why do I have to do the, not have to, but why do we come and sit here together? Why don't I start my own thing? Why do I have to, why do I sit, why do I not, you know, do something else, like, really be out there?
It's really describing a process, a natural process. It isn't anything we have to do or have to be. It's how things work. So even with upside down views or perverted views, it all naturally falls off if we practice. And the more deeply we practice, the more thoroughly everything falls away. So we can't make it happen. We can bring ourselves to the cushion and try not to fall over. But that's just about it. And offer ourselves to the process, which is what we do. And something brings us back to it. It feeds us in some way.
Hmm.